Shalom. Welcome to another episode of Inspiration from Zion. I'm Jonathan Feldstein, and I have the privilege of being your host, coming to you from the Judean Mountains here in Israel. I like to refer to it as the original Bible Belt. Inspiration from Zion is a program of the Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation, whose mission is to build bridges between Jews and Christians with Israel in ways that are new, unique, and meaningful. I pray that you'll find this all of those. Through this program, we're excited to connect you to people and stories in and relating to Israel to give you a window to look through, experiencing aspects of life here that you wouldn't otherwise know about. We want this to be interactive, so always please feel free to be in touch with us at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com and send along any questions and any comments about any topic anytime. Or feel free to reach us at genesis123.co and follow and like Inspiration from Zion on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Stay tuned until the end, where we're going to offer you an exciting opportunity. And please always feel free to share this conversation with others you know will find it of interest. I just told my guest today how tremendously I am anticipating having her on this call. It's got to be at least 2 months ago, I read a review of her magnificent book. And I didn't know it was that good, but I knew the topic was really hot and I wanted to read it. So I reached out to Yardena Schwartz, and her book, you can't see it because of my fake background, it's called Ghosts of a Holy War, the 1929 massacre in Palestine that ignited the Arab-Israel conflict. It's so timely and so well done, and I'll probably say it a few times, but just so I don't forget, get the book. I really, really encourage it very strongly. Yardena, I'm going to read from the dust jacket inside the book. Yardena Schwartz is an award-winning journalist and Emmy-nominated producer who worked at NBC News, including stints at the Today Show, Nightly News with Brian Williams, and MSNBC's Andrea Mitchell Reports. Her reporting has appeared in the New York Times, New York Book Review of Books, Wall Street Journal, The Economist, Time, National Geographic, and Rolling Stone, among other publications. She graduated with honors from Columbia Journalism School in 2011 and received an Emmy nomination for her work at MSNBC in 2013. She then spent a decade reporting from Israel, earning the 2006 RNA Award for Excellence in Magazine Reporting. And she now lives in New York's Hudson Valley. Yardena, really, truly, this is not just platitudes. I'm so excited to have you. I think what you've done, and I'm really interested to hear the backstory of the story, is so well done, but so timely. It's sort of like you just stumbled into everything being more than just a story about what happened in 1929, which many of our followers don't know about, to something that's tremendously contemporary today. So first of all, thank you and welcome to Inspiration from Zion.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. I'm so happy to be here.
I wanted to say, you know, one of the things that I especially liked about your book is that it reads like a novel. That has to do with your writing and the beginning, where you're telling the story of a man named David Schoenberg. And I want you to tell us about him and how you... He feels like a character, but he's not. He was a real person. And you develop that character from the information you got, but you also weave him in so beautifully into life in Memphis, where he was from, and New York, where he spent a little bit of time on his way to come here to Israel. And you weave it in so beautifully, like it's a story. Before we get into the story itself, would you explain for people who are following, it's referred to in the book, and I saw an interview you did recently. People refer to Palestine, but they don't know that in 1929, Britain controlled what was then called the territory of Palestine, that it was not a country. What was that about? Why was Great Britain here to begin with?
So British Mandate Palestine was what Palestine, or the Land of Israel, was known as under British rule, which lasted from after the fall of the Ottoman Empire at the end of World War I, which was when the British took over Palestine, which until then had been a province of the Ottoman Empire for more than 400 years. And that mandate that the British held to govern Palestine lasted until 1948, when the British evacuated. Before they evacuated, they turned over the future of their mandate to the UN to decide what would happen there, because they knew that both the Jewish minority and the Arab majority in Palestine wanted independence. They had not been able to find a solution between the two parties because the Jews had agreed to share the land and the Arab leaders had rejected every effort to do so. And the UN ultimately in 1947 voted to partition the British mandate of Palestine into two independent states. One would be for the Arabs of Palestine, the other would be for the Jews. Again, the Jews embraced that plan. And once again, sadly, the Arab leaders rejected it and actually declared jihad, which began in 1947 as a civil war between the Arabs and Jews of Palestine, eventually became a regional war in 1948 when the British left Palestine, Israel declared independence, and ultimately Israel had a shocking victory, you know, that neither the Jews of Palestine and then Israel expected, and nor did their enemies. In my book, I quote an Egyptian official saying that they expected to take over Tel Aviv in 2 weeks. He called it, he said it was going to be a parade. And yeah, so that was what, when I refer to Palestine in the book, I'm referring to either the British Mandate of Palestine or to the province of Palestine under the Ottoman Empire before the British.
Right. What's so interesting, and by the way, it's a pet peeve of mine, because my father was born here. My father, I call him an original Palestinian, because under the British Mandate, it was only the Jews who were referred to as the Palestinians. And when the Palestine Post, the Palestine Philharmonic were all Jewish entities. And one of the crazy things in my life, I was speaking to somebody about it. In all of my life with my father, I never spoke to him about what it was being an 11-year-old boy at that Declaration of Independence, living in Haifa, which is a mixed city of Arabs and Jews. And I wish I could have a couple hours back with him to do that. Your story begins, your book begins, with the story of David Sheinberg, who was a young Jewish American from Memphis. How did you come into his story to be able to tell that?
So really, I am lucky to have been gifted with any writer's dream, which is this family in Memphis, Tennessee. So David's descendants, they discovered a box of letters in their attic, and they were all written by David from Hebron between 1928 and 1929. And while they knew that David had traveled to what was then Palestine in 1928 to study Torah in the land where its stories had unfolded, they knew that he had been killed there. They didn't know much about the massacre that took his life. They didn't know about his time in Hebron. They didn't know much at all. And they just discovered hundreds of pages of his letters, which were beautifully written. I mean, he was only 22 when he wrote these letters, but he wrote like, I mean, I was floored by his writing. It was beautiful. It was so descriptive. It was so vivid. And, you know, the fact that my book read like a novel, part of that is thanks to David, because he really brought Hebron of 1928 and 1929 to life in his own letters. And so it made it easier for me to piece together the life that was lost, not just his own, but the lives of so many others who were killed in that massacre. And also just what Palestine and, you know, the land of Israel was like before this massacre that really upended the future of Zionism, of the Jewish people, of so much of the history in this place we talk about so much was written then and determined then by this massacre.
I only thought of it now as you're narrating this. Is it sort of like finding Anne Frank's diary? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was really blessed to be entrusted with these letters by this family in Memphis because they gave me complete editorial creative freedom to do what I felt needed to be done with these letters. So instead of just telling a story about David, this remarkable young man from Memphis who did what, you know, today it's common to, you know, leave the comforts of America to go study at a yeshiva in Israel. That's very common among, you know, Orthodox young men or modern Orthodox, even, you know, conservative and reform Jews. But in 1928, young men did not leave their families and sail to Palestine to study Torah. And David, he had a really promising life ahead of him. His father had arrived in the U.S. as a penniless immigrant from the Ukraine. His parent, you know, David's parents both fled Ukraine, fled pogroms and anti-Semitism. And they were poor, but built themselves up into very successful business people. They owned a retail store in Memphis that then became a chain of retail stores. And David had worked in his father's store as a young boy, and he went on to go to study at Wharton. He dropped out of business school at Wharton to study Torah and then moved to Palestine to study Torah. And this was not something that was, you know, his parents thought he was crazy. Actually, his parents were so opposed to his move that they didn't.
That's what I wanted to ask. It wasn't just crazy. They were against it.
Yeah, they were against it. And he only managed to go because his parents didn't pay for it. And he was, you know, he didn't work at the time. He was only 22 when he moved. His ticket to Palestine, which would have been worth more than $4,000 in today's currency, was paid for by a very distinguished rabbi, whose name was Rabbi Wolf Gold. He went on to become an early Zionist leader. He was one of the few religious Jews to sign the declaration, Israel's Declaration of Independence. So it was really fascinating reading David's letters and seeing these names of people who he just kind of casually mentions, but who went on to play really important roles in the founding of the state.
You know, it was interesting when as I was reading the book, I didn't know where you were going with it. I just knew I needed to read it. And we're getting toward the sort of the climactic moment of the massacre in Hebron, I noticed, well, there's still another probably, I don't know, 200 pages to go. And I was really wondering where you were going to go with it. But I felt as I was reading it, because I knew what was going to happen, that I was watching the movie Titanic, where you're so engaged and you know what's going to happen, but you're thinking, oh no, he's gonna be saved. But it wasn't that way. It wasn't that way. Can you talk about what happened? People who don't know, even people who do know, as you said, I knew about the massacre, but you, with his writing, you made it come to life.
Oh, sadly, because he was killed in the massacre, the last letter he wrote was actually just 4 days before he was killed. So to piece together what happened that day of the massacre in Hebron, I actually read hundreds of testimonies from other survivors. So just to give some background, in Hebron in 1929, there was this small, very pious community of Jews, just 800 Jews living amongst 20,000 Muslims in Hebron. And they lived there because Hebron is the second holiest city in Judaism, the burial place of Abraham and the rest of the matriarchs and patriarchs of the Jewish people. The Jewish community had lived there for thousands of years, and their lives were centered around the tomb of the patriarchs and matriarchs, where Abraham and Sarah and Rebecca and Leah and all the rest are buried in this tomb of the patriarchs. And at the time, Jews and Muslims lived there peacefully. I mean, they weren't equal citizens. The Jews living in Hebron were very much, you know, treated inferior to the Muslim population because Muslim rule had existed in Palestine for 1,000 years up until that point, until the British came into power. And so one example of that is that the Jews living in Hebron were forbidden from entering the tomb of the patriarchs. Only Muslims could pray inside. Actually, Christians were also forbidden from entering. Yet the Jews still prayed there, but they prayed outside outside the walls. And yet they existed harmoniously together with the Muslim population. They owned businesses together. Many of the Jews living in Hebron rented their homes from Arab landlords. Yet that peace and that camaraderie began to disintegrate as a result of a campaign of propaganda and fear-mongering that was perpetuated by the leader of Palestinian Muslims under British rule. That his name was Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, the equivalent of the chief rabbi of Palestine. He was the most important Muslim religious leader in Palestine. And what he did was, around the same time that David Sheinberg arrived in Palestine from Memphis, he began to spread a rumor that the Jews of Palestine planned to destroy Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem in order to build their ancient temple. So for those listeners who don't know what Al-Aqsa Mosque is, it's the third holiest site in Islam. It's a mosque that stands atop the ruins of the two ancient Jewish temples in Jerusalem and is known to Jews and, you know, non-Muslims as the Temple Mount because of the history of that place. But it's a very sensitive subject in the Muslim world. I mean, what I found interesting was that back in 1929, the presence of the Jewish temples in that place was, you know, accepted and even spoken about among Muslims. It was a point of pride that this was the site of the ancient Jewish temples. Today, many Muslims, not all, of course, but especially within Palestinian society, it's considered Zionist propaganda to say that the Jewish temples once stood below Al-Aqsa.
The restoration of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel was an earth-shattering event. For Christians, it was a confirmation that God always keeps his covenantal promises. Today, we are blessed to see God's fingerprints in the modern miracle of the land of Israel playing out in our lives among the people and in the state of Israel. This year, on the occasion of Israel's 75th anniversary, the Genesis 123 Foundation has been privileged to bring together 75 Christian leaders from around the world to lend their unique voices, sharing their personal faith experiences relating to Israel and their in-depth insight into Israel's history and spiritual significance to create an historical, one-of-a-kind, high-end coffee table book, Israel the Miracle. Israel the Miracle's stunning imagery will fill your home with the hope of fulfilled promises and conversations about Israel. It's a perfect gift to anybody for any occasion, and most of all, to yourself. You'll also be a blessing to Israel, knowing that the proceeds will go to bless Israelis of all backgrounds. Be a part of Israel the Miracle and bring the land, the people, and the state of Israel into your heart and into your home. Visit israelthemiracle.com to get your limited edition copy today.
Anyway, so the Grand Mufti began this rumor that the Jews in Palestine were planning to destroy Al-Aqsa Mosque to rebuild their ancient temple. And that began to kind of just chip away at the trust and the friendships that had existed within Hebron and throughout Palestine over the course of a year. And while there were many Muslims who resisted that propaganda and refused to give into it and actually ended up saving more than 200 Jews the day of the massacre, 3,000 Muslim men participated in the massacre that day. So out of 20,000 Muslims in Hebron, 3,000 participated in these riots where they went from house to house in the Jewish quarter and, you know, in scenes that are very reminiscent of what was seen on October 7th, they went from house to house hunting down Jewish children, women, men, elderly, and 67 unarmed Jewish men, women, and children ended up being slaughtered that day by their Arab neighbors.
Right. So it's actually, I wanted to talk about the numbers for a minute, but when you're talking about 3,000, interestingly, 3,000 is about the number of terrorists who came across the border from Gaza on October 7th of 23. But 3,000 represents plus or minus half of the adult men of Hebron at the time. And 67 Jews slaughtered plus another, was it 58 or how many were injured?
It was around 70 that were injured.
So you're talking about more than 10%, 15% of the Jewish population either being killed or injured.
And according to the Jewish victims who survived and the British chief of police who was in Hebron that day, the Jews who were saved by their Muslim neighbors, the 200 Jews who were saved, they would not have survived if they weren't saved by their Muslim neighbors, if they weren't hidden in the homes of their neighbors. And those who, the other Jews who survived, those who weren't saved by their Muslim neighbors only survived because they played dead. And they were able to play dead because they were covered in the blood of the people around them who were killed.
Which also we just read from some of the hostages being released, that they had to exist for hours and hours and hours under the bodies of people who were killed like that. I want to continue about that, but when you were talking about it, and it's something I've never really spoken about, but I don't go to Hebron often. I actually had a very interesting experience there. One of the things that we do with Genesis 1, 2, 3 is in the winters, I make huge pots of soup and just deliver it to soldiers who are stationed all around the area. If you're watching this, you can see where I live, all around the Judean mountains down to Hebron. And my kids love taking the soup down there. In the summers, I'll tell the local grocery store owner to chill 100 kilos of watermelon and 100 liter and a half bottles of drinks. And I drive on a Friday and I deliver watermelon and drinks. And I went with a friend of mine, not this past summer, maybe it was 23 before the war began, or maybe it was in 22. I don't remember. And we decided as we're driving into Hebron, hey, why don't we also give to Palestinian Arabs? Why not? I mean, it's hot for them too. And some were gracious, but the kids, particularly when I would stop the car and get out anywhere near any Arab kids, they would scatter as if I was there to kidnap them or kill them. And it was so sad to me that was the case. But that was a digression. The Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs, you talk about going in. One thing that always puzzles me about that it's really set up like a Muslim shrine. How does that make sense? Knowing what you do, having written this incredible book that you've written, how is it that while we have Abraham in common, all of the rest of the matriarchs and patriarchs are not part of the Islamic narrative, but it's like a Muslim shrine?
After the Islamic conquest of Jerusalem and other areas around the year 700, the many Jewish holy sites were turned into Islamic holy sites. So, you know, we have the case of the Temple Mount becoming Al-Aqsa. So before the Tomb of the Patriarchs was turned into a mosque, it had actually been turned into a church. So just to give some more background. So in the Hebrew Bible, we read of how Abraham purchased this cave. Right. Later in the first century, that cave became this shrine. And that was a result of the Jewish Roman King Herod turning it into this kind of fortress-like building, which if you've been to Hebron, it really is amazing because it's one of the last examples of Roman architecture that is still standing in one piece and also still serving the same purpose it served when it was built in the first century,
wow,
which is a place
excellent
of worship.
Point.
It's really amazing. It's massive. And today it serves as both a synagogue and a mosque, which is also very unique. But the reason it's holy to Muslims and the reason why Hebron is a holy site in Islam is because Abraham isn't just revered as a prophet in Islam, but he's also considered the patriarch of the Arab nation through his sons, Esau and Ishmael, for the Jews and for the Arab people, Esau. So that kind of goes to answer your question about why it's revered in Islam.
Got it. Okay. I want to go back. Before we go back to talking about the massacre on August 24th of 1929, I neglected to ask you earlier, and I'm really curious more about David. Again, you how amazing that you had all his letters and that they were preserved as they were. What did you like? Do you feel like you knew him? Tell us about him. this lead character, if you will, in your book?
So, of course, I never, you know, could have known enough about him. And I always wanted to know more and, you know, wished I could have interviewed people who really did know him. Sadly, you know, he was killed in 1929. So the people, even, you know, the elderly members of the family, all their memories were of him were just passed down from stories of their parents who were his brothers and sisters, because he was the eldest son. He had four siblings, two sisters and two brothers. And I really got to know him through his letters, which were so long and so vivid and so vulnerable. He wrote so often of how much he missed his family and how he wished they would write him more often. You know, I could really relate to him as someone who also moved to Israel alone. I made Aliyah in 2013. I moved to Israel at the age of 27. I moved there alone. I'm from New Jersey. I was different from David because he was a very religious young man. He went to Israel to study the Hebrew Bible. I was a journalist and, you know, a secular Zionist, you know, not religious. And I moved to Tel Aviv, which is kind of the polar opposite of Hebron in so many ways. But I kind of related to him through his letters. And also I read his diary, which was not written in Hebron. Sadly, the diary he kept in Hebron, we know he kept a diary, but it was destroyed or lost in the aftermath of the massacre. But he did keep a very lengthy diary from before he went to Hebron. So from his days at Wharton, from his days when he had gone back to Memphis before he moved to Hebron. So I really got to know him through his own writing and through the stories that his elderly family members had heard through their parents. So his, you know, nieces and nephews. And he was really just this amazing young man. He, while he was alive, he had started this anonymous fund at the yeshiva in Hebron, and he didn't tell anyone. I mean, the staff at the yeshiva, the directors of the yeshiva knew that he did it because, you know, they had to know, but none of the students who benefited from this fund, which was for the needy students, many of them would come with, you know, had no support from their families and needed money for, you know, clothes and books and things like that. He started this fund with his own money and he contributed to it. And they only knew that it was him who had done this after his death. And the yeshiva director told the students that it was David who had started this fund. So it was just one example of, you know, what an incredible young man he was. And also he was really admired by other yeshiva students because many of them had come from religious families and, you know, they had been, you know, raised to study Torah, or they had been told to study Torah by their parents. Whereas David was the opposite. He, you know, he was Jewish. His parents were Jewish, but his parents were secular. They had really expected him to pursue a future in the family business, not learning Torah and perhaps becoming a rabbi, which was his dream.
And certainly not coming to Palestine.
Yeah.
Right. That was probably when he went to New York. That was about as far as they ever would have imagined. Right. Yeah, really incredible. I was just telling my wife before that we were having this conversation. Now, she hasn't gotten to read the book. Usually when I bring a book home, she steals it and reads it first. But I needed to. And it was very, really, really well done. Let's go back to the days leading up to August 24th, but also the day itself. We don't need to get into the gruesomeness of it, although as you correctly, and maybe we will, talking about the present, the parallels are haunting. Go ahead.
I was just going to say it's telling that you almost refer to it as October 7th, and I myself do that often when I'm speaking about August 1929 and the massacre. I sometimes almost say or accidentally say October 7th because these massacres were so hauntingly similar that it's really astonishing that there is a century between them. Yeah. You would think that, and I thought reading the testimonies of these victims and writing about them, that we would never see anything like this happening again in our lifetime. It was just so barbaric what was done in 1929. And really, You know, we saw it not just repeat itself on October 7th, but on a more massive scale. You know, I spoke about this a little bit earlier, but, you know, you mentioned the similarity of the 3,000 men. You know, in 1929, they were marching through the Jewish quarter, not with AK-47s, but with swords and daggers and axes. Like October 7th, there were women and teenage girls were raped before they were killed, and the mobs did that in front of their families. And infants were slaughtered in their mothers' arms in 1929. Children watched, you know, in shock as their parents were butchered by their own neighbors. It was really just horrific. And this was all done in one day, just like October 7th. So, right. You know, in you asked about the days leading up to it. The massacre in Hebron was actually part of a much larger event, which is referred to as the riots of 1929. Those riots began one day earlier in Jerusalem at Al-Aqsa. So this campaign of propaganda sort of climaxed in the month of August of 1929. There had been a Jewish demonstration at the Western Wall, the holiest site where Jews were permitted to pray because the Temple Mount was off limits to non-Muslims. And so Jews prayed at the Western Wall as they had for generations. And over the course of that campaign of propaganda, what the Mufti also did was work to limit Jewish access to the Western Wall. Because aside from being the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, he was also the head of the Supreme Muslim Council in Palestine. And that Supreme Muslim Council technically owned the Western Wall because it was considered part of the Al-Aqsa compound, part of the Temple Mount. And so he worked to limit Jewish access to the Western Wall. And at the same time, his campaign of fear-mongering and propaganda led to increasingly frequent Muslim attacks on peaceful Jewish worshipers at the wall.
Friends, Israel's at war, and the war may get worse before it gets better. Much worse. It's going to be a long war because the enemy is the epitome of evil. It's not just a matter of overcoming troops on a battlefield, but overcoming a theology, an ideology, an evil one. While the Genesis 123 Foundation has been overwhelmed with the support of so many donations to the Israel Emergency Campaign, there's so much more that needs to be done. We've invested your donations that we've received so far strategically to make the biggest impact possible, whether helping with soldiers and their equipment and personal needs, to providing civilian security for outlying border communities, to relocating and settling several families from near the Gaza war zone, launching the global petition drive to support Israel in the face of pressure for a ceasefire, and long-term needs for at-risk children, traumatized now more than ever before. Please take a moment to pause this conversation right now and go to love.genesis123.co and donate generously. We value your trust, and we will keep all donors informed about how and where your donations are being used to contribute to make the biggest impact possible. And when you use that link, love.genesis123.co, you can also send your prayers and words of encouragement to Israelis of all backgrounds, just sending your love, something that we need so desperately. Thank you. And God bless you and your loved ones.
And so what happened in August 1929 that led to this kind of boiling over of all this tension was Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av, the saddest day on the Hebrew calendar when Jews mourn the destruction of the temples and many other catastrophic right. events in Jewish history. And hundreds of Jews marched to the Western Wall protesting against the British failure to protect Jewish worshipers and protesting against the British failure to dispel this campaign of propaganda and to respond to these efforts to restrict Jewish access. And they were calling on the British to give ownership of the wall to the Jews of Palestine. And that was exactly what the Mufti needed to say to the Muslims of Palestine, look, I told you, they're trying to take over Al-Aqsa. If we don't do something now, they're going to destroy it. And so that campaign just kind of went into overdrive after that. And this demonstration, by the way, was peaceful. And yet within the Arabic press, And within the Arab leadership, they spread rumors throughout Palestine that this peaceful demonstration at the Western Wall was nothing but. They claimed that Muslim women had been raped at the Western Wall. They claimed that the demonstrators had cursed the Prophet Muhammad and beat up Muslim worshipers. And none of that was true. But the truth had become irrelevant at that point because of this campaign of propaganda and disinformation. And so everything just spiraled out of control after that. And on August 23rd, these riots erupted after Friday prayers at Al-Aqsa Mosque when thousands of Muslim worshipers descended from Al-Aqsa to the Old City of Jerusalem and started to beat up Jewish passersby, set fire to Jewish businesses, and the riots just engulfed Palestine. And over the course of the week, literally every Jewish community in Palestine was evacuated, and 133 Jews were killed in that 1 week, more than half of them in Hebron, which had until then been seen as this beacon of coexistence in Palestine. You know, it was considered the safest place for Jews in Palestine.
Right. And accordingly, what made it very easy for the Arabs to kill the Jews is that no one was armed. No one thought that they needed to be armed. And you, I don't know if you want to say anything about it, but you depict the Israeli security, the Haganah, the pre-state security going there and saying, hey, you need guns, you need weapons, this is happening. And they were in denial, which also is hauntingly similar to what happened on October 7th, especially in those border communities that thought that coexistence was what existed, so to speak.
Or really the Israeli government had, you know,
also
reassured everyone that, you know, Hamas is not interested in a confrontation. They want, you know, they just want to govern Gaza. When these Israeli soldiers, many of them female, were reporting to their supervisors that they were seeing really horrifying, you know, practice runs on the other side of the border that told them, okay, they're preparing something that we're not ready for. They were all just dismissed as, you know, no, Hamas is not going to do this. And, you know, our border fence is strong enough. We don't need to send more battalions down there. And, you know, the same, I mean, obviously very different because there was no Israeli army in 1929. There were no Israeli soldiers. There was no state of Israel. But there was the Haganah, which would eventually become the nucleus of the IDF. It was the underground Jewish Defense Force that was really at that point, you know, very bare bones operation. They were only really active in a few cities at that point. They weren't based in all of the different Jewish communities, but they had sensed that the riots that they sensed were going to erupt would hit Hebron. And one of the reasons the Jewish leaders in Hebron rejected their offers of protection, and they had also been offered to evacuate to Jerusalem until the riot subsided, the Jewish leaders of Hebron unanimously said, you know, no, we don't, we trust our Arab neighbors. They're our friends. They won't hurt us. And also they were sure of that because when previous much smaller riots had erupted and reached other parts of Palestine, they hadn't reached Hebron. So in 1920, when the Grand Mufti actually instigated another riot in Jerusalem and he was wanted for arrest by the British, he fled into Transjordan and was then pardoned and welcomed back and appointed to his post by the British.
Right.
You know, we can talk about that as well, about the, you know, this, the role of appeasement and rewarding terror, which only breeds more terror. You know, this has a long history going back to 1920.
So I do want to talk about that, but you set me up because I also wanted to ask about the British. The British were they controlled the mandate. They were the protectors. They maintained law and order. During the course of this period, Jews and Arabs were arrested and some were sentenced to death, and the British carried out the death penalty on Jews and Arabs during this period. I don't remember all the detail, and that's why I'm so glad I have your book as a reference, but there was it seems to me a great culpability of the British for not doing anything to preempt, prevent, and certainly significantly protect the Jews in Hebron at that time. Can you elucidate or clarify on that?
Yeah. So on top of the British failure to counter the lies that were being spread by this leader of Palestinian Muslims who had been appointed to his post by the British,
right.
Not only did they not counter that propaganda and prevent these efforts to restrict Jewish access to the Western Wall, but when the riots erupted, there was an absolute failure to quell them, a failure to protect the Jewish subjects of the British mandate, who they were obligated to protect. In Hebron, what that looked like was the British police chief, who had a force of about 40 policemen, all but one of them were Arabs. And many of them actually participated in the massacre, if not just, turned a blind eye. So this wasn't across the board. There were policemen who did try to help, but they were just overpowered by the sheer numbers of rioters. Yeah. But the British police chief himself, he was despised by the Jewish community after the massacre because there were so many stories from victims of him just telling the Jews before when it was clear that the massacre had started, he just told them, stay in your homes and you'll be safe. That was his solution. Meanwhile, their homes were being broken into and they were their doors were being chopped down literally with axes. And his response before, when they were all telling them, what are you going to do to protect us? He just said, stay in your homes. And then, what happened during the massacre was he didn't fire his gun on the rioters until they started to turn their sights on him. So, it's really interesting because when I looked into the British press after the massacre, he was treated as a hero and lauded as, this man who had single-handedly saved the Jewish community of Hebron. Right. But really, when you ask the Jewish community of Hebron, and if you look at the Jewish press in Palestine, that he was seen as, allowing it to happen, almost like a willful participant. So, there's such a resonance of narratives and, diverging narratives that fuel this conflict, but it's interesting how even the British narrative is something that is in the mix here as well.
Yeah, thank you for that. Let's talk about the ideology, the text on the book cover, the 1929 massacre in Palestine that ignited the Arab-Israel conflict. It wasn't just a massacre, and there was an ideology behind it. And you talked about Haj Amin al-Husseini being the lead actor in that, but we see that still today. And we also see that, I don't know to what extent, I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood grew up at around that time, and I don't know if, to what extent that Husseini was influenced by that, or he had his own brand of Islamic extremism. But can you help us understand the parallels and why we're still dealing with this?
Yeah, so one of the reasons that we see this conflict persist after one century is because the forces that drove it back then are still driving it today. So, a lot of people speak about the roots of this conflict being 1948 when right. Israel was established, yet that's like starting a movie halfway through or start, you can't start at 1948. These tensions had existed long before. And, like I said earlier, in 1947, there had been an effort to bring about two states for two people, what we call today the two-state solution. It wasn't called that then. Yeah. But I mean, there has been the option of living together in peace for a century. And time and time again, that option has been embraced by the Jewish natives of Palestine, the Jewish leaders of the Old Yeshuv and the New Yeshuv, the Old Yeshuv being the Jews who had lived in Palestine kind of pre-Zionism, and then, the Zionist wave. So, and then at the same time, all of those efforts to reach a peaceful solution being rejected by the Arab leaders of Palestine. So that wasn't just in 1947. You go back to 1936, when the British held what was called the Peel Commission, and they were already trying to see if a two-state solution could work then. And it was so interesting reading these testimonies from that commission, because Haji Amin al-Husseini said even then that, you know, the 400,000 Jews who were living in Palestine at the time, he was asked straight out, you know, could they stay? And he said no. So, you know, today when we hear the talk of, you know, free Palestine from the river to the sea, yeah, and people talk about how, you know, oh, that's just talking about, you know, a free country for all people. No, you know, it's been very clear for a century that the leaders of the Palestinian people, and I'm not referring to all Palestinians, I'm talking about their leaders, who have refused to share this tiny sliver of land with the Jewish people, whose homeland is in this land. And, you know, the Jewish people going back to, you know, 1936 have been willing to share this land. And, you know, not just 1936, 1947, 2000, 2008, all of these efforts to share this land have been, you know, embraced by Jewish leaders and rejected by Arab leaders. And, you know, if somebody thinks that this is about, you know, settlements or oppression, I mean, the question, then if this really is about settlements and oppression, then why wouldn't those efforts to end the settlements and oppression, why would they have been rejected if that was really what this is about? And also, why would we have seen such a similar massacre with such similar driving forces and language around it? Why would we have seen that in 1929 when there was no, you know, when there were no Israeli soldiers?
There were no Israeli soldiers, and Jews weren't even in control, and living here at best as a protected minority. Wow.
Yeah. And if you, and talking a bit more about the ideology, all you have to do is listen to the main players in this conflict to understand that that is what it's about. You know, if you listen to Hamas, if you listen to the footage that they uploaded after October 7th, or on October 7th, they're not calling for free Palestine. They're not calling to end the occupation. They were unanimously shouting, Allahu Akbar, God is great. And they were declaring the glory of Islam. And that's exactly what we heard from the rioters in 1929 as they marched through the Jewish quarters of Hebron. They were shouting Allahu Akbar. They were praising Islam, shouting about the need to defend Al-Aqsa from the Jews. And, you know, October 7th was named the Al-Aqsa Flood for a reason, because this disinformation campaign about a supposed Jewish plot to destroy Al-Aqsa remains today. And, you know, when the ceasefire was declared and Hamas declared victory, Hamas leaders were calling the liberation of Al-Aqsa and the Al-Aqsa flood operation a success, and vowed to continue in their effort to liberate Al-Aqsa.
As remarkable and miraculous as Israel is, and its very existence a testimony to God's faithfulness, in many ways, Israel's like most other countries. Just as there are parents anywhere who have stronger and weaker parenting abilities, and adults become a product of situations in their lives that they cannot control, making their ability to raise and care for their own children even harder, that's true in Israel as well. The Genesis 123 Foundation is committed and takes the mandate seriously to care for the least of these, our brothers, our children. We're committed to bless and strengthen orphans and at-risk youth, to invest in them, to empower them, so that their future will be brighter than their past or their present. But Israel is unique in that there are always threats of war and terror which know no bounds. For children who come from homes that are not safe, sometimes the very scary reality of living in a community that's not safe is too much to bear. We are committed to turning orphans and at-risk youth into children of promise. We fund a variety of programs to help those most in need as widely as we can. We invite and encourage you to join us today so that we can ensure their brighter tomorrow. Please visit genesis123.co to find out more and to send your love and most generous donation today.
One of the contributing factors for both of these, October 7th and 1929, was the belief that we could coexist, that coexistence was in fact happening, albeit in a very different way, with a very strong barrier between us and Gaza. And unfortunately, that seems to have been, I guess, pun intended, blown up. That sense of naivete is a contributing factor to our loss each time.
Well, I think that it's important to note here that coexistence has always been possible and could have been possible had it not consistently been hijacked by these corrupt extremist leaders who have it in their interest to ignite this conflict and initiate these, you know, destructive campaigns of violence, which in the end up causing more destruction to the Palestinian people more than anyone right. else. So, you know, it's really just tragic how the moderate peace-seeking people among the Palestinian population, they're not able to be heard or able to make a difference because the extremists have just this dominating, grip on society that makes it impossible for them to speak out, because if they do, they have to fear for their lives. Many of the Palestinian moderates within Palestinian society do not live in the West Bank or Gaza, because if they did, they would have been killed by now. And so it's really just devastating how these extremist corrupt leaders have managed to dictate the destiny of not just the Palestinian people, but the people of Israel for the last century.
Sure. So I don't know if I've shared with you, but I'm leading up to a question that we as the Genesis 123 Foundation are promoting what's called solutionforpeaceingaza.com. We'll put that maybe in the notes. My point is not to talk about that or promote it, but you just said something really fascinating, and you're a great writer and a journalist, and I don't think it was a slip of words. You said coexistence could have been possible. You didn't say could be possible. What's the solution? You've not only lived here, you're engrossed in what's going on, but you've written a really critical book. And you've researched it. This is a lot of research. All those footnotes, very impressive. What's the solution, Jordana?
So I said it could have been possible because I think that October 7th really set any hopes for peace back many years, perhaps a generation, if not more. It's no secret that the two-state solution was already on life support before October 7th. But for many peace-seeking Israelis or, you know, left-wing Israelis who really believed in the need for a Palestinian state alongside Israel, not just for the Palestinian people, but for Israel's future as a Jewish and democratic state, that hope, much of that hope was really torn to pieces on October 7th, because it became clear, not just from Hamas's attack, but from the broad support that attack had from within the Palestinian population. So many polls showed that among Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank, something like 70% of people supported the attack of October 7th. And so, you know, for many Israelis, and also, of course, the people who suffered most on October 7th were left-wing Israelis, the kibbutznikim, who were killed, many of them were peace activists, or those who were kidnapped were peace activists. So, you know, it's going to take a long time to rebuild the trust of the Israeli population in the necessity and the possibility of a two-state solution, and also for the Palestinian population. I mean, so the lives of Gazans is, it's not a life right now. I mean, their lives have been completely shattered. And none of that would have happened if it wasn't for Hamas's sadistic attack on October 7th. But I mean, I think that's all kind of just a symptom of the problem. The problem at its core is what I was speaking to about earlier, about the ability of extremist, corrupt Palestinian leaders to hijack the future of their people. And not just by starting these wars that end up bringing more destruction to their own people, but also by failing to improve the lives of their people with the massive amounts of aid they have received, billions of dollars in aid from the international community. And the international community has failed to put conditions on that aid that require them to improve the lives of their people. You know, Palestinians are the most, you know, if you speak to a Palestinian about their own leadership, they're more critical than anyone. I mean, the Palestinian Authority is considered hopelessly corrupt, and for good reason. I mean, you know, there's so much nepotism, so much funneling of aid into the pockets of corrupt leaders in the Palestinian Authority. And of course, Hamas, you know, using the massive amounts of money it got from Qatar and Iran, not to improve the lives of Gazans, but to, you know, build a tunnel system akin to the New York City subway. So, you know, as long as this is the reality within Palestinian society, and you know, the reality I spoke to about earlier, where moderates and, you know, dissidents aren't able to speak out because they could be killed. Not just could be, I mean, they are killed. We've seen so many times throughout the war in Gaza that any Palestinian who criticized Hamas was either beaten or killed. And we've seen that even since the ceasefire as well. We've seen, you know, Hamas thugs in the streets shooting people who were critical of Hamas rule. So long as that is the reality, we're never going to see peace, because to have peace, you have to have two partners, and you have to have, you know, a Palestinian leadership that is going to agree to the offer on the table at the end of the negotiation process, which is, you know, what happened in all of the previous negotiations. Was after all of this effort, you know, whatever agreement was come to was just rejected at the end by whether it was Arafat or Mahmoud Abbas. So I think that's the solution, empowering these peace-seeking moderates who could be the next generation of Palestinian leadership, you know, young Palestinians who want to see a brighter future, who want that money to go into, not into fighting Israel and working to destroy Israel, but into building a state, and who want to live in peace alongside Israel. Those people do exist. It's just that we don't hear enough from them, because sadly, if we did, they might be killed.
Correct. Thank you for that. I think I have a last question. You're a tremendously award-winning journalist, a gifted writer. You've done tremendous research. And as a journalist, you have to remain balanced and objective. Your book isn't objective. It's honest. And it has to be honest. But I'm curious how researching and writing the book, and then overlaying that with what happened, and you tie in the October 7th massacre. Mm-hmm. How did it change your views and your identity, yourself?
Yeah. So, I mean, like every Jewish person around the world, and especially as an Israeli as well, I was directly impacted by October 7th. I mean, you know, thankfully I don't have any family members who were killed or kidnapped, but my husband's two of his cousins were murdered on October 7th. And my daughter was in Hebrew school at the time with a Hebrew school teacher here in New York, who is the uncle of Shiri Bibas and Ariel and Kfir Bibas. And, you know, we came to Hebrew school on October 8th. It was a Sunday. And he was in tears telling us they didn't know where his sister and her husband were. And they feared that she had been taken to Gaza. And within weeks, we discovered that his sister and her husband had been murdered. They're the parents of Shiri Bibas. It's often overlooked that, you know, Shiri wasn't just abducted to Gaza with her children, but her parents were murdered on October 7th. Right. So, you know, it's really changed me forever. I mean, I think of my life as being, you know, pre-October 7th and post-October 7th. And it's, you know, I often wish we could just go back to October 6th. There's this innocence and this kind of, you know, pureness of life that existed before October 7th. And it's just so devastating to think that there are people who not just celebrated October 7th and then, you know, cried about the devastating consequences of October 7th on Gazan civilians, but are now declaring victory and vowing, you know, that Hamas should do it again. And it's just, you know, really depressing.
And as we have this conversation, it's real important. I'm going to assume that you and I know this. We live this. We wake up, we breathe it, we ingest it all day, and it's part of us, and pre-October 7th and post-October 7th. But some people don't know, the same way they didn't know about the Hebron massacre until now. They don't know who Shiri Bibas is and her children. Mm. And they're the two beautiful little boys who were 2 and 10 months when they were kidnapped, and the
redheaded boys,
redheaded, gorgeous redheaded boys. In fact, as we're having the conversation today, has been dubbed like Orange Day. Everyone's supposed to be decked out in orange and putting orange on their social media. And we know that the Bibas family is on the list of the hostages to be returned in this first stage. By the time some people are hearing this conversation, that will have passed, but the tremendous fear is that they're all dead. It's hard to imagine two little boys surviving what adults have barely been able to survive or not. And that's to be continued. Did you want to say something? No.
I mean, I was just going to say that as we speak, you know, they were supposed to be released by now, and Israel is demanding that Hamas release them or explain what, you know, what their status is, because their family and so many of us don't know.
It was heartbreaking. Actually, I was in front of their home, and stood where she stood, where that terrified picture. I just get chills and might want to cry thinking about what was in her mind then as she's holding her two little boys. It's horrific.
And my children, when you know, we saw her uncle at Hebrew school, I was shaking because I was imagining my children are the same age. My children are 2 and almost 5, which is the same age as Ariel and Kfir. And it's just, you know, it's terrible.
We need to take a breath, but I want to give you, Yordana, the last word. What have we not covered, other than my saying enough that your book is tremendous and everyone needs to get it? And again, it's Ghosts of a Holy War. What else do people need to know before we say goodbye now?
Well, thank you. I think that the message that I would like to get across is that peace is possible, and that we shouldn't give up and just accept this status quo, because accepting that this is, you know, our future and our children's future is unacceptable to me. I think that, you know, the international community is so interested in seeing this conflict resolved, but has clearly ignored the very sources of this conflict. And I think it owes all of us, you know, Israelis and Palestinians and humanity, the effort of empowering the future Palestinian leaders who could change this trajectory, because it's only, you know, it really rests on them.
Okay. Candid, honest, and optimistic, which is hard to be optimistic these days. Thank you for that. Yordana Schwartz. I don't do a lot of these podcasts as a book review, but yours is more than a book review. It's unpacking a critical piece of the last 100 years of our history. And I thank you for doing this, and I thank you for sharing it, and I hope people will read it. And thank you for joining us here.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. It was really a pleasure.
As we've always done, wrapping up the conversations, the Genesis 123 Foundation wants you to have an opportunity to get a special gift for yourself. And for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, we call it From Jonathan's Bookshelf. I always look up at my bookshelf about all the great historical books that now I get to put Yardana's book alongside and try to find a place next to Elie Wiesel and the James McDonald, the first U.S. ambassador, and Yoni Netanyahu and Natan Sharansky and all the others. So you got a great place of honor here, Yardana.
Thank you.
But for the last 16 or 17 months, the book that we are offering every month has been our book. It's called Israel the Miracle, 75 essays by Christian leaders from all over the world writing about why Israel is so significant. And all we ask that you do is follow and like Inspiration from Zion on social media. And when you share or comment, we pick one person at random every month to receive a copy of our book as our gift to you. We're always grateful that this podcast is sponsored by our friends at the Willow Run Greenhouse in Culpeper, Virginia. If you're ever in the area, I don't know if anyone's done this, but if you're ever in the area, pop in and thank them for helping make conversations like this possible. And also special thanks to the Coyne family for their meaningful sponsorship. Inspiration from Zion and all the Genesis 123 Foundation programs are made possible by donations. So please consider joining us to help continue making dialogues like this possible. And as we don't know what, as we speak today, the status of the Bibas family and many of the other hostages and those who are scheduled to be released and those who are not yet on a list, 65 additional hostages who are simply not on a list. This episode, especially with the topic, Yordana, is an honor and to provide strength for the hostages and their families and all of us who are going through this. And I pray that by the time people are actually listening to this, many, many, many more will be out, all of them. If you'd ever like to sponsor an episode in honor or memory of a loved one or special occasion, please be in touch at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com. As always, we'd love to hear your comments as part of a dialogue and invite you to send any questions as well, especially questions about traditional Judaism for our Ask the Rabbi programs. Please share this with others who will also find it of interest and continue to join us right here as we bring you more meaningful conversations about unique topics relating to Israel that you won't hear anywhere else. Wherever you are in the world, I pray that you and your loved ones are all safe and healthy, and I send my blessings from right here in the Judean mountains. God bless you. Hallelujah.